to Sight.
Spend the day with Sight.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Sadam, dear listeners, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai welcoming you to this week's afternoon satsang. I have with me Brother Arvind. If you're a regular follower of our satsang, you will know that we are in the middle of our Ramakatha fortnight, and so we are going to be continuing with the story of Ramayana as written by our dear Lord. But before that, as always, we offer our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, to the feet of Lord Hanuman, whom we believe is with us whenever we take up the name of Lord Rama, and remembering the most nectarous and sweet name of Lord Rama, let us begin this week's afternoon satsang.
Shri Raghavam Dasharatatmajama Prame Sitapatim Raghukulanmaya Ratnadipam Ajanubahum Aravindadalayataksham Ramam Nishachara Vinashakaram Namami Namami Namami
Sairam, dear listeners, in our previous episode on the afternoon satsang on the Ramakatha Rasavahini, we had met a very poignant and emotional scene, a scene where Brother Bharata is bidding goodbye to his dear brother, to his Lord, Shri Rama, in order to do his bidding, in order to do Lord Rama's bidding. We had an elaborate discussion on the prema versus dharma battle, if you may call it so, which happens not only between Bharata and Rama, but which happens always between a devotee and the Lord. It was a very enlightening and refreshing discussion for us. And in case you missed it, do go to our previous episode and hear about it. We shall now be continuing from where we left off last time. Before that, we have received feedback from several listeners asking us to package this entire Ramakatha Rasavahini series as one, because apart from Lord Sri Rama's stories, there are a lot of our Sai Rama stories that are interspersed in this serial, in these episodes. And it is natural, because we have only read about Lord Sri Rama, but we have been blessed to experience a part of Lord Sai Rama's glory. So it is natural that these two get intertwined with each other. Definitely, we shall definitely try to package this entire series once we have completed the Ramakatha Rasavahini serial. So that is the response to all those lovely mails, which definitely filled our heart with great joy and enthusiasm. So now we have the entire entourage that has arrived from Ayodhya on a return journey back towards Ayodhya. Rama has commanded them to leave. Rama has offered his sandals to Bharata, and instead of wearing them, Bharata decides to place them on top of his head. He decides to give them the utmost importance, and therefore he carries it on his head. And prostrating to Rama, embracing him, lots of tears, lots of love, lots of warmth. After all that, King Janaka and his entourage turn back towards their kingdom of Mithila. Bharata and the entourage turn back towards Ayodhya. And this is when the return journey begins. Just as the onward journey filled them with great joy and anticipation, this return journey is filling them with sorrow. Now that is a beautiful thing that we see here, because in the onward journey, as the time passed, they were getting closer and closer to Rama. And now they know that as time passes, they are getting further and further away from Rama. So there is a kind of sorrow that is there in the entire contingent. But then, that is true devotion, because though they might have great sorrow, they are doing their Lord's bidding. Devotion lies not in doing whatever one wants, but in being happy doing whatever the Lord wants, even if it means personal sorrow and grief. And therefore, with great devotion, the entire entourage from Ayodhya is now headed back towards Ayodhya.
And in Ayodhya, what happens is, you know, another aspect of the character of Bharata, which says that he was very serious about, you know, whatever he was doing, because he calls for a coronation ceremony in that sense, because he has still not been coronated as the king of Ayodhya, as the boons of Kaikeyi demanded. But then what happens is, he asks for a coronation ceremony to be arranged, and the sandals which he brings, as you said, most ceremoniously from Lord Rama, he prays to Vasishtha that these sandals be enthroned, and mm-hmm. they be enthroned as the ruler, and he would rule on behalf of, you know, that symbol of Lord Rama, and that's what happens. And after that ceremony, he takes the blessings of all the mothers, and apparently nobody has any opposition to that. You know, there is no mention of any kind of opposition, whether it is in Ramakatha Rasvani or in any other versions of Ramayana, because everybody feels that that is the next best thing they can settle for, not being able to convince Rama to come back. And also Swami beautifully narrates how the citizens of Ayodhya who could not make this journey, how they are eagerly waiting for days together, you know, for this retinue to come back. And when they see them coming back, and they see that they are tired at the end of that journey, and the moment they see the tired faces, they realize that they've been unsuccessful. Because, you know, they know that if they had been successful, the joy would have overtaken the sorrow on their faces. And yes, the ceremony happens, the sandals of Rama are enthroned. And after that, immediately, Bharata and Shatrughna rush towards a place called Nandigrama. That's what Swami says. And, you know, they build a thatched hut for themselves, and they continue to live in the same manner Rama, Sita and Lakshmana live. In the sense, they, you know, they too mat their hair, they wear the clothes of a hermit, and they begin living like those who are in exile.
Actually, it is not exactly living in exile, because we see that while Bharata and Shatrughna are there in Nandigrama, Bharata is more involved in the austerities. It is not as if they neglect their duties towards the kingdom. We'll possibly come to that later. Right now, I remember an episode that took place during a Trai session.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Swami was seated on the jhula and he was speaking about the 9 forms of devotion. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Pada Sevanam, Vandanam, Archanam, Dasyam, Sneham and Atma Nivedanam. And it was a very, very interesting discourse, because Swami revealed the true meaning of each of these pathways, or each of these modes of worship, if one may call so, or each of these ways of devotion. And the insights that he gave were amazing and very, very interesting. and insightful. I want to concentrate particularly on the Pada Sevanam. When he came to Pada Sevanam, Swami is mentioning that people think that sitting in the front and pressing the Lord's feet is Pada Sevanam. But that is not so. And correctly also, because right now how do we do Pada Sevanam? Where do we find those beautiful feet of the Lord to press? So, pressing the Lord's feet physically is possibly only symbolic of Pada Sevanam. Swami then went on to explain what is true Pada Sevanam. He said, when the avatar descends to the earth, when the Lord comes in human form, there is a path that the Lord treads. A path that is shown as an ideal for all of humanity. That's why Swami says, my life is my message. In the sense, Swami says, you need not listen to what I say. Just see the life. Just see the life that Swami has led. And we will realize what a message Swami's life is conveying to us. So, there is a path that the Lord treads when He comes on earth. To follow in the footsteps of the Lord is true Pada Sevanam, Swami said. And that was such a profound point that Swami made. It is not enough if you just sit and physically press the Lord's feet. There's nothing great in that. Possibly you get momentary joy. Because I also remember on one occasion when I got this chance, it felt like the best thing in the universe, Prem. And you sat there pressing his feet. But within 20-25 minutes, you know, your forearms start aching. Because all said and done, it's a human body, it has fatigue, and your forearms start aching. And believe me, though I might sound crazy saying this, at that time you just wish that, Swami, I want a break from pressing your feet. What you think is the greatest boon that anybody can get, you actually don't want that boon, because all said and done, that is not true Pada Sevanam. At the same time, if you ask anybody who follows the footsteps of the Lord, I don't think there's anything like tiring from following the footsteps of the Lord. Following the path on which the Lord has tread. There's only joy and peace supreme. And so therefore that is true Pada Sevanam. And here it is very symbolic. Though Bharata has enshrined the sandals on the throne, it is only symbolic. And even him going to Nandigrama shows that Bharata has decided to tread on the path that his Lord has tread. And Bharata took it to the extreme by doing it even physically, but it just shows that Bharata follows whatever Rama follows, whatever Rama does, whatever Rama says. That is what, you know, Swami also used to tell us often, that you should lead your lives in such a manner so that your lives also become my message. I'm sure that was the case in Bharata's case, where Bharata's life became Rama's message. That is why later on we will see Swami narrates in a discourse as to how the citizens and denizens of Ayodhya get confused between who is Rama and who is Bharata. So much has Bharata trod in the footsteps of Rama that one is unable to make out even physically the difference between Bharata and Rama. So that is a message I think all of us must take as to what true Pada Sevanam is, and realize that Pada Sevanam is very much possible even today when we feel that Swami is physically not with us, because true Pada Sevanam is following in the footsteps of Swami.
Very true. Remember, if you look at what Bharata has done here, what strikes me is, you know, all of us have a certain kind of attachment to Swami, and all said and done, at the end of the day, what Bharata is having is a certain amount of attachment. You know, even after we spoke about the debate between Rama and Bharata and how Janaka gave the right resolution. I think end of the day, it's a resolution for the intellect. You know, the buddhi has been satisfied that yes, this is the right path. But I think some part of you is still not satisfied. Some part of you is still hurting, and some part of you is still saying that, you know, it would have been better if Rama comes. And many times when you feel a surge of that love, when you feel a surge of that surrender in you, you know, there is no way to express it. There is no way that it can find expression in your daily life. So you kind of search for options by which you can give an expression to it in your own life and feel a certain amount of satisfaction. You know, that's what happens with Bharata, because he still feels a certain amount of repentance. And if you see Indian mythology, if you see all the Puranic stories, always a kind of a healthy expression of this repentance is actually penance. Many of the people you would see that, you know, when they do something which is wrong, even we have the story of Parikshit. Of course, Parikshit says that I have 7 days to go. What do I do? Every time they see what is the most sublime option available for your regret, for your feeling of repentance. And that's what Bharata also does. And in fact, if you look at it, when you talk of Padasevanam as, you know, following the footsteps of Swami, and very true what you said, physically doing Swami, I was reminded of a talk which I heard of Gada Sundar Iyer. You know, he, one day when Swami asked him, what do you want? He says, Swami, I want to serve you in your, in your private apartment. And Swami says, okay, start coming from tomorrow. So he's surprised that, you know, he landed that most coveted job so easily with just one prayer. And from the next day, he starts going into Swami's room and starts serving Swami, you know, takes care of the bedroom and all that. And he says that, you know, there are about 3 or 4 students who are all there taking care of Swami. And that time when, you know, after Swami comes back from a darshan or after an extended session, they would have this opportunity of pressing Swami's feet. So being that new kid in the block, every time Swami would come and sit, he would run and take the opportunity to press Swami's feet. And he would see the other senior boys would very readily allow him to go and, you know, do the Padseva. So he was wondering, how come nobody is, there is no fight for this chance? And Swami, you know, in those maybe mid-80s, Swami was himself very well built. He would say that, you know, when you would press Swami's feet, you would see that Swami is really muscular and really hard. And after a real long day, Swami would want Padseva to be done with a lot of might. You have to really press Swami's feet.
Very vigorously.
Very vigorously. And Swami would say, Inka, press a little more harder, press a little more harder. And he would say that 20 minutes to half an hour, you would feel your whole forearm burning. That's how tough it would become. And he would say that, you know, that's when your body takes over your mind. Till then your mind is thinking that, oh, this is such a precious chance, this is such a precious moment, and you've been craving for it. And when the aches of the body starts taking over the mind, that's when, you know, that tiredness comes in, and that's when you start telling that, Swami, it's enough. This blessing is enough. Give me this blessing in some other form.
See, some other time.
Right. In that sense, when Swami was giving that opportunity for Padseva, Swami was giving his blessing in a tangible form so that we could accept it. Similarly, I feel when we feel that love and the surge of love for Swami, we seek some tangible expression for that love. And what Swami says is, yes, for that Padasevanam is the option. For a short while, it is this physical Padasevanam, but for a long term, for a expression which would benefit you as well as those around you, it is this subtle Padasevanam which Swami says, where you have to take to my message, you have to take to the path. In fact, I think in another discourse, Swami says that a form of Padasevanam which Mother Yashoda did was following the footsteps of Krishna. In a way, you know, Krishna would purposely leave the footsteps in with the butter, and Yashoda would follow it. Some would say that is also a form of Padasevanam, where you try to follow the footprints of the Lord in search of the Lord. And I think even that is a beautiful way, because when, as you said, now where is the physical option for Padasevanam? Where Swami has left his footprints, and if you follow it with the full faith that you're looking for Swami, at the end of the footprints, you're definitely sure to find Swami there, I think.
In fact, when we read through the Ramkatha Rasa Vahini, that is what comes through. While on one hand, we read the description of how Bharata is engaged in thinking of Rama. The next chapter, actually this is the first chapter of the second book, the Ramkatha Rasa Vahini part 2. So, in that sense, you know, we have completed part 1 of the Ramkatha Rasa Vahini. In part 2, if we see the first chapter, it begins with Rama, Lakshmana and Sita in Nandigrama. In Chitrakuta. Chitrakuta ashram.
But otherwise in Nandigrama. Because they're sitting and talking all the time about Bharata.
Yes, that is what I was coming to. They're physically in Chitrakuta, but they're remembering Bharata. I remember another little episode here. You know, I think a year or two after we had joined Radio Sai, Professor Venkatraman sent us on a task of photographing all of Swami's water project reservoirs. Not all of Swami's water project, the Anandpur water project reservoirs. So, this project has reservoirs, huge storage reservoirs in different places. And I remember one as Bukkaraya Samudram, huge place, huge reservoirs. And so we hired a vehicle, and it was a full day job. You know, first of all, it takes so much time to travel there. And then once you reach there, it's so huge that you can't shoot, take pictures of it from the ground. You have to climb to some elevated spot and take the image. So the whole day, entire day went in that, and we missed darshan actually, both morning and evening, because we set out early in the morning. By the time we returned, it was late in the night. Throughout the journey, you know, we were speaking about Swami and also about Professor Venkatraman, and at the end of the journey, you know, we were talking among ourselves as to, you know what, today whole day Swami and Professor G.V. must have had hiccups because we were speaking so much about them. That is what we thought. The next morning, the first thing Professor G. Venkatraman tells us is that, you know, yesterday Swami and me were speaking only about you. You meaning you boys who have gone out, you know, you going and photographing there, and he asked us that, didn't you get any hiccups? Because, you know, and when he said that, I felt so thrilled. I remember noting this down in my diary also. It felt so thrilling because just as we were thinking of our Lord was also thinking about us. It felt so beautiful, and that is how Swami is. You know, that's why he says, you take one step towards me, I'll take 1,000 towards you. If we start searching for the Lord will also start searching for us. That is the truth, and that is what we see even in the Ramayana. Here, as Bharata is remembering Rama, Rama is remembering Bharata, and, you know, exuding joy and peace at the pristine nature of Bharata's love and Bharata's devotion. That is what happening is happening at Chitrakuta Ashram. If you see on Google Maps, there is a Chitrakuta Ashram that exists even to this day, towards the southern border of the state of Uttar Pradesh. It's at a distance of about 300 kilometers from Ayodhya. So that is just a fact I thought I'll reveal here. I'll mention here. So Rama, Lakshmana and Sita are at Chitrakuta thinking of Bharata, while Bharata is at Nandigrama thinking of Rama.
And of course, from here starts the journey of, you know, the I think they're moving southward, right?
They're moving southward.
Southwestern direction, I think, to be more precise.
Correct.
And they move from one ashram to the other. And in the process, I think, a couple of interesting anecdotes which come in the process.
In fact, one happens at Chitrakuta peak itself, which involves the son of Indra, Jayanta.
Right. There is this mischievous fellow, nothing more than that, nothing harmful. You know, he is... because, you know, if we see the story of Lord Krishna when he's in Vrindavan, you have Indra himself trying to come and test him. Because, you know, that's the power of Maya. If you go through all these stories of the avatars, they would say that at some point, even deities like Brahma, deities like Indra, they get the doubt. You know, is he the one who has come down as our, you know, Lord Vishnu? Is he the one who's going to defeat this Ravana, I mean this Asura or whatever it is, is he going to accomplish the task? Especially in the Krishna avatar, I think it was more. Because when they saw this little boy, you know, frolicking and playing with his little playmates, many episodes where all these deities come and test. I think he was just another person like that, because he was seeing this Rama, Lakshmana and Sita, this trio coming there. He wanted to test the might of Rama. That's how Swami narrates it.
Jayanta.
So he takes the form of a crow.
This is the son of Indra.
Right, he is the son of Indra, one of the sons of Indra. So he takes the form of a crow and he comes and starts pecking at the sole of the feet of Mother Sita. And does it so hard that she starts bleeding. So immediately Rama very casually, he just picks up a dried grass and throws it at this crow, which then becomes a missile or, you know, a ball of fire which starts pursuing this crow. Then eventually this crow transforms into this Jayanta and he starts pleading with Rama. He says, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have done this to test you. And he takes recourse at Rama's feet. And that's when I think Rama forgives him and blinds him in one eye. And he says that, all right, I forgive you with this. And I think at the same time, even Lord Indra prays to Rama seeking forgiveness on behalf of his son.
Exactly. So Jayanta becomes a one-eyed crow who stays at Chitrakuta for a while, After which, after some time, Rama himself says that it's time for you to leave, and so he leaves. You know, again, looking at this episode, we know Lord Rama stands for the Paramatma, and Mother Sita for Prakriti. Mother Sita stands for the feminine aspect of creation, while Lord Rama, the Lord always stands for the masculine aspect of creation. And reading this episode, the way Swami has narrated it, one cannot help but think that the Paramatma, the Lord, is very, very forgiving. He does not mind any injustice that is meted out onto Him. But if anybody even harms Prakriti to a little bit, that person will face wrath. This is, again, I feel a metaphorical, it has got a metaphorical message for all of us. You know, Prakriti is nature. If we tamper with nature, if we harm nature, to whatever slightest extent, it might not even be with the intention to harm nature. Just like you said, Jayanta had no evil intentions. He didn't want to harm Mother Sita or anything like that. Even playfully, just out of mischief, because your idol and an idle mind becomes a devil's workshop, you don't know what to do, and so you peck at Prakriti and cause Prakriti to bleed, cause damage to nature. It is going to come back to you manifold. And we see how even a highly modified punishment becomes blinding in one eye. So, it is definitely a message for all of us that we have to be careful. We have to revere Prakriti as we revere Paramatma himself. How we worship and pray to Lord Rama, in the same way we have to worship and pray to Mother Sita as well. Because there is no difference between the two. Prakriti is just part of the Paramatma. That is what Swami would also time and again say in his discourses, that Parameshti, or the Lord whom we worship, is actually there in Prakriti or Srishti. He would draw a hierarchy where he would say that the Vyashti or the individual is part of the Samashti or society, which is part of Srishti or nature, which is in turn part of Parameshti or God. So he would say that if you want to worship the Lord, you have to worship society, you have to worship nature. And this message comes through this story very clearly to all of us.
And also this is an interesting description of the character of Lord Rama. You know, I think if you remove these episodes, it looks like he's the most forgiving, he's the most calm, he cannot be angered, but if you look at this episode, even such a small thing calls for a strict action from Lord Rama. In fact, there is another episode, I think, in the Valmiki Ramayana it is there. Mm-hmm. You know, when the ministers and the council come from Ayodhya and try to convince Rama. In the process, there is one particular sage who comes and gives a very ridiculous argument. You know, he says that something to the effect that Dashrata's words need not be taken seriously. And he gives a particular, you know, using that typical Tarkashastra, he gives an argument which says that you can come back and rule, and, you know, there is a little bit of ambiguity and gray area in which, you know, you can take the thing. And for that, you know, Valmiki says the way Rama responds to it is very, very caustic. You know, he tells that how your argument is flawed, and he says that at any point, I mean, I should not look for the easier option. And this is the word of my father, I have to follow it. And then he starts saying that, I'm really surprised how my father chose you to be a part of his, you know, council of sages, because he's a sage who comes and talks to him. So, you know, there are some aspects like this in the Ramayana where they say that, you know, Rama was a very, very strict person also, in spite of him being, you know, easily lovable, and he's so kind and he's so compassionate. But at the same time, he was not somebody who was, you know, resisting from taking stern action at points where it's necessary. I think there will be a lot of episodes in this particular Aranyakandam where, you know, Rama rebukes. In fact, there is one particular dialogue, I think we'll come to that a bit later, where Rama gives a word to the sages, saying that I will protect you at any cost, and, you know, anybody comes to harm you, I will take it upon myself as a duty, and I will vanquish them and protect you. And then Mother Sita says that, you know, who are you to give a word like this? Because all said and done, you're walking into the forest which is not your area. You know, you're a king of Ayodhya, and your jurisdiction is there, but how can you come into the forest and give a blanket protection like this? And that is when Rama explains that, you know, this is the role I've come to play. you know, I've come into the character of a prince of Ayodhya. That is only the starting point. But by any ways, this is the role I've come to play. Anybody who takes refuge under me, I will protect them. So I think that character of Rama is beautifully brought out in this scene, as we see, and the scenes which are to follow, because there are a couple of interesting anecdotes which Swami narrates.
So, dear listeners, we will take a little break here. Do be tuned, because what's coming next is, again, some interesting anecdotes, some interesting episodes, which carry a lot of profound meaning and implications, as always. So we will take this little break, and after the break, we'll continue with the trio who at Chitrakuta.
Dasharata Nandana Dayavi Rama Shri Ramachandra Jaya Ramachandra Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama. Shri Ramachandra Jaya Ramachandra Chandra, Jaya Ramachandra,
Ramachandra, Jaya Ramachandra,
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama,
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama,
Hey Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama,
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama.
Ramachandra Jaya Ramachandra
Ramachandra Jaya Ramachandra
Dasharatha Nandana Dayabhirama
Dasharatha Nandana Dayabhirama
Dasharatha Nandana Dayabhirama
Dasharatha Nandana Dayabhirama
Dānava Bhanjana Kodanda Rama
Dānava Bhanjana Kodanda Rama
Dānava Bhanjana Kodanda Rama
Dānava Bhanjana Kodanda Rama
Kalyana Rama Kamaniya Nama
Kalyana Rama
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama
Shri Ramachandra Jaya Ramachandra
Shri Ramachandra Jaya Ramachandra
Dasharatha Nandana Dayabhirama
Dasharatha Nandana Dayabhirama
Raghukula Rama
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama
Raghuveera Ranadheera Raghukula Rama
Shri Ramachandra Jaya Ramachandra
Welcome back, dear listeners. Hope you enjoyed that very melodious bhajan which praises the Lord Ramachandra as the victorious one, as the supreme one. Now, before we leave Chitrakuta, because after a while the trio Rama, Lakshmana and Sita left Chitrakuta and proceeded further, before we leave Chitrakuta, we would like to go back again to that episode of Jayanta, who comes as a crow, because there are so many messages that we can derive from that episode. In fact, we feel that we can have an entire satsang just on that one episode. In many of his discourses, Bhagwan mentions that the original creator, the only thing that existed in the beginning, is the Atma. From the Atma comes ego, or our sense of I, mine and thine, all this. So Swami says that the ego is actually the child of the Atma. And from this ego comes the mind. And so Swami says, therefore the mind is the grandson of the Atma. And you know, Lord Indra, whose son Jayanta is often compared to the mind.
Right.
And you see that Indra at some time is a super god. At some times he's shown as a god who is, you know, very frivolous and so on and so forth. Because that is how the mind is. The mind is capable of great things. At the same time, it's capable of pulling you down the spiritual ladder in no time. Which is why Bhagwan says, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo. Mind is responsible for evolution, for your liberation, as well as for your bondage. And so since Jayanta is the son of the mind, the son of the mind is something that is subservient to the mind, that is under the mind, which is the senses. So we can possibly take Jayanta as a representative of our senses. Now again, this incident becomes so significant because many times we cause damage to nature, to Prakriti, just in order to satisfy the craving and desires of our senses. And just as playfully as Jayanta did. For instance, I want to go and enjoy swimming in a resort. You know, my intention there is not to harm the nature there, or, you know, because setting up a resort means a lot of water, there's a usage of a lot of resources. My intention is never to deprive anybody or harm nature in any manner. But unknowingly, just like Jayanta did it, we actually end up hurting nature. You know, there are so many wildlife reserves in Africa. And when we go to Wikipedia or read about any of these reserves, most of the reserves get endangered because of excessive poaching or excessive tourism, both which are a result of attraction from the senses. While, of course, poaching is done with a little more evil intent, tourism definitely seems to be quite a harmless thing. But still, it is something that caters to the senses. So this episode of Jayanta the Crow becomes very significant because the other message that it gives us is that our senses that crave for things, that desire for things, unknown to us, can actually cause damage to Prakriti, to Mother Nature, just as Jayanta did to Mother Sita.
Right. In fact, I think the best way to look at Ramayana in that sense is to see the subtle aspects of this, because as the story, as we've mentioned this so many times, the story, we know it, episodes of this we would have heard many, many times, and, you know, different interpretations of this. But I think any story is best taken when you draw the interpretations from it, from your level of thinking too. You know, sometimes it can be conveyed to you, as Swami would tell in many of the discourses. But most of the time, you would see that Swami would even just tell the story and let the lessons for the person who is listening to be taken from, instead of it being given. So I think it's important for each one of us to keep going back to these stories and to draw messages, as in when we are maturing, you know, in our intelligence too. So in that sense, it's very important to go back to these stories again and again. And continuing the story, of course, from this episode of Jayanta, Swami says that the three of them travel in search of another hermitage, and they come to the hermitage of sage Atri and mother Anasuya. And just to for those listeners who might not be aware, sage Atri is the father of the avatar of Dattatreya, and it comes from, you know, the boon which Mother Anasuya gets from the Trimurtis like Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara, where she has the opportunity to mother this avatar who is actually a representation of all the three of them. So Dattatreya is born to sage Atri, and that is the ashram where Rama, Sita and Lakshmana finally reach. And the moment they come, you know, they're given, sage Atri realizes who's the guest he's having the honor of hosting, and he, you know, calls them. And Anasuya takes Mother Sita aside, and, you know, she starts praising Sita, and she says that, you know, people might not know who you are, but I recognize you. And then, you know, sage Atri arranges for something like a banquet or something like a assembly where Rama is called, and he is introduced to the other renunciants in the ashram, the sadhakas in the ashram. And Mother Anusuya brings Mother Sita there. And that is when I think one of those rare moments where Mother Sita reveals who Lord Rama is and who she is. Where she says that, you know, you can give me all the praise, but the fact is, everybody assembled here and every single individual in this humanity has an aspect of femininity in them, and that is the aspect of Prakriti. And she says, I am the representative of that feminism in each individual. I am that femininity of, you know, in each individual, because I am Prakriti. And there is only one person who is completely masculine, and that is the Purusha himself. And the embodiment of that Purusha is Lord Rama. So in that sense, he is Purusha and I am Prakriti. And this is the revelation which Mother Sita makes in that assembly of sadhakas at the ashram of sage Atri.
You know, there's also this episode in the life of Mirabai where there is a Krishna Bhakta, a devotee of Krishna or a Jnani, I forget his name. He refuses to see Mirabai because he says that I don't come in touch or I don't come in the come into the proximity of women. To which Mirabai sends a response, which goes as, I thought that there was only one Purusha for the entire universe. And again, that highlights the truth that only the Lord is a Purusha, everything else is Prakriti, which is the feminine aspect. The story goes that after that, that Jnani or that person is enlightened, and therefore he meets with Mirabai. Coming back to this part here where everything is feminine, Swami in his discourses mentions, you know, that there is a positive and a negative.
Mm-hmm.
I was just reading some science facts and something about science. In physics and in science, one of the least understood things is this concept of matter and antimatter. Now, they say that physics itself has understood very little of it. So, I'm here to impose what little I have understood of the little that they have understood. So, while reading it, it was very, very interesting because while reading it, I just felt this is so close to discovering what Swami says about the positive and the negative about the Paramatma and Prakriti. You know, basically what is antimatter is a kind of negative matter. For example, there is an electron. Mm. Electron is a negatively charged particle with negligible mass.
Right.
The antimatter of the electron is what we call a positron. Well, positron, it's been named because it's a positive electron. Basically, it has the same mass of the electron. It has the same properties of the direction of the electron, but in the opposite direction. And it has a positive charge because the electron has a negative charge. In the same manner, there is a thing called antiproton.
Mm-hmm.
This is very strange because, you know, proton has a mass that is almost 1500 times that of an electron. So it's a very heavy particle. And a proton has a positive charge. Now, an antiproton has a negative charge. So it's almost like an electron with one negative charge, but it's not an electron because it is as heavy as the proton. So it goes on this way. In fact, antimatter is created when antiparticles combine. When an electron and a proton combines, we have hydrogen, right? In the similar manner, when a positron and antiproton combine, you get antihydrogen. Antihydrogen actually exists. And it is said that when matter and antimatter come together, that is when electron and positron come together, there is a tremendous surge, tremendous release of energy. And nothing exists after that. You know, because matter cancels out antimatter, antimatter cancels out matter. So basically, that famous Einsteinian equation of E is equal to mc squared, energy is mc squared. That's what happens. And it is said that this is one of the perfect reactions, perfect transformations, perfect conversions, where the entire mass, without exception, gets converted into energy. Now here comes the interesting aspect why I felt it is very, very spiritual. It is said that when the Big Bang took place, matter and antimatter both got created. Because it is said that in the beginning there was nothing. We don't know what was there before the Big Bang. From nothing, everything has come. We can deduce this from the fact that when matter and antimatter come together, nothing is left. So something came together and nothing is left but energy. So working backwards on this, in the beginning possibly there was just energy. You call it in whatever name you want, Atma, God, consciousness, whatever. There was this energy. And that energy is what embodied into both matter and antimatter. Now, the interesting thing is if there is 50% of matter and 50% of antimatter, we would not have had the material universe at all. Our universe would have been a universe of pure energy. Only energy, because matter and antimatter cannot exist in the presence of each other. They just cancel out each other, releasing tremendous energy. But what something very interesting happened, what the scientists call as asymmetry. An asymmetry happened because of which a lot of matter and less of antimatter has been created. So even to this day, there are matter-antimatter collisions releasing tremendous energy. But since matter is much, much, much more compared to antimatter, we have got what we know today as the material universe. It is because of the asymmetry, thanks to the asymmetry, that we have a material universe, that we have creation. If not for the asymmetry, there would be no creation at all. You know, it makes all the concepts that we read about in mythology so much scientific. You know, when they say of pralaya, dissolution, nothing you have to do, you just have to remove the asymmetry. You remove the asymmetry, matter, antimatter clash out, and you have just pure energy left. Everything, creation is destroyed. So, you know, it inspires one to think that this asymmetry is possibly what is called Maya, because Maya is what separates Prakriti from Paramatma. That makes us unable to see the same Paramatma and Prakriti, you know. That is what brings about duality. That is what brings about a material universe and an antimatter material universe, however we may term it. So it is Maya. It is Maya that brings about the separation and creation, just as it is the asymmetry that brings about separation of matter and antimatter and brings about creation. So one is positive, one is negative. And it is so amazing that all these scientific concepts today so easily blend with our mythology, blend with what was said then. You know, 100 years back, 200 years back, you talk about Paramatma and Prakriti as the only thing existing, nothing else. Paramatma is positive, Prakriti is negative, everything is feminine. It all would have been rubbished. No wonder people condemned, you know. But the beauty is all that has survived. And today when they see that our scriptures, you know, the Sanatana Dharma is so metaphorical, and it so easily blends with whatever latest discovery and researches that science is making. It is nothing short of a marvel. And even as I spent time reading about matter and antimatter, I was so thrilled to see that it was so perfectly in sync. And therefore, I just felt it would be relevant to mention it here when Sita is talking about Paramatma and Prakriti, masculinity and femininity, the only positive and negative. And of course, she also speaks about Maya. Maya which makes the entire creation as a dual universe. So that Maya is nothing but the same asymmetry that the physicists speak about.
Very true. I think it's a very, very deep topic, which, you know, Prakriti and Paramatma, because in some of the discourses which Swami explains, I think he uses a lot of science to explain that. Even in the 1975 50th birthday discourses, Swami actually uses a lot of this you know, scientific understanding of when you go deeper into the atom, you finally have to say that everything is nothing but some form of energy. You know, something is a visible form of energy, which you sometimes call matter. And everything else, if you were to just call that energy as divine, if you were to just label that energy as Paramatma, you would see that it's the substratum. There's nothing can exist without that. And, you know, what we call Maya could just be limited understanding. You know, when your understanding becomes absolutely profound and complete, you would see that you're talking of the same thing, whether you see it or you don't see it. Maybe sometime later we'll dwell into that and see what all Swami has said in it. If only we could just, you know, cull out some of those wise words from Swami's discourses. After this episode where, you know, they are in the ashram of sage Atri, they move forward and they go to another ashram. And I think the only reason why Swami is bringing this ashram in, because there is no reference to this ashram. Swami doesn't say that this ashram belongs to such and such a sage, or whom Rama and Sita meet in that ashram. He just say that they go to another place. It's a beautiful ashram. There seems to be some inhabitation there. So they go there, they refresh themselves, and then they move on. But in the process of that, Swami, you know, reveals this vow which they've taken. Because when the ashramites request that Rama and Sita should stay on there, like it happens in every ashram, where that is when they reveal that they've taken a vow that they won't stay in any one particular ashram for more than one night. And that is the vow they've taken upon themselves, and because of which they have to move ahead.
That is what actually happens even at the ashram of sage Atri. Anybody whom Lord Rama visits wants him to stay on forever there. But he keeps moving on, and therefore, yes, Swami mentions about this beautiful hermitage. After they move on from this hermitage, comes a sudden, you know, there's a kind of a fearful atmosphere that is created, because there's the appearance of a demon, Viradha. Now, Viradha comes, and this is possibly one of the first few demons that Lord Rama encounters in the exile. And he comes menacingly towards the brothers. Swami writes how Lakshmana engages this ogre or demon in battle, and it's a fierce battle that is ensuing there, and Sita is terrified. You know, again taking a little aside, every time if we keep in mind about Mother Sita being Prakriti, about Rama being Paramatma, and you know, demons are nothing but embodiments of the six vices: Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada, Matsarya. So even if we see it in that metaphorical sense, it makes such beautiful meaning. Prakriti gets scared in the presence of Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada and Matsarya. So therefore the Lord comes to destroy these six vices and save Mother Earth. That is the metaphorical meaning. That's what is directly happening there. Is Sita is getting scared and she hides behind her Lord, and she knows that she's safe behind the Lord. That is another beautiful thing. It brings out Sita's faith. Though she is scared of the ogre, she is very, very firm in her faith in her Lord Rama. She feels that the ogre, however menacing he may look, however dangerous he might be, he is nothing but a little fox compared to the lion that Lord Sri Rama is. So she knows nothing can touch her if she is with the Lord. That's another message for all of us. Nothing can touch us if we are with the Lord. And so Rama sees that Lakshmana is actually tiring in battle, because a long battle is ensuing over there. He decides to step in and help. And Swami writes that he fixes a crescent-headed arrow to his bow, and with one arrow severs the head of Viradha. And that is the end. You know, throughout I think we will see this, where Swami always says that Rama had the vow of okay bana, okay mata, okay patni. That is one word, one arrow, one wife. So every time when Rama annihilates any demon, it happens with just one arrow. And so with one arrow he kills Viradha. And when Viradha dies, a kind of a celestial or heavenly being emerges from the body. And that is when the story of Viradha is narrated.
The interesting thing is, if you see this very episode in the Valmiki Ramayana, which I was just going through, this is actually quite a chunky episode there. And Swami actually finishes this in one paragraph in the Ramakatha Swaini compared to the other episodes, because this is quite a battle which happens there.
Between Virada and Rama,
because he comes and there is a altercation where this Virada says that I'm going to eat you up, I'm a man-eating demon, and I'm going to take Sita for my wife. And in fact, Valmiki says that he even abducts Sita, and that's when this battle starts between Rama and Lakshmana and this ogre. And one of the things which this ogre is having a particular boon, the boon is he cannot be killed by any weapons.
Uh-huh.
That is why they're able to, remove his limbs. They're even able to behead him, but they're not able to kill the ogre. And that is when the ogre, says that, Rama says, according to the Valmiki Ramayana, Rama says that, see, I think this demon will not be killed by any of our weapons. So let us dig a big pit and we'll bury this, demon there. That's the only way he can be killed. The moment Rama says this, then this Virada, he says that, I understand that you are Rama who has come to, release me from the curse. And then he says he's actually a Gandharva by name Tumburu. He's one of those celestial musicians and from the kingdom of Kubera. So the story goes that he is with the other Apsaras when the king Kubera comes, and he kind of belittles him by not recognizing him and continuing with his play with his playmates. And that's when he gets cursed, that you'll go and become an ogre like this, and then after taking pity, he says that Lord Rama will come and release you. And that is why I think even the Ramakatha Swami says that Rama actually completes the, final obsequies of this Rakshasa.
Final rites.
He does it for this Rakshasa, gets him buried, and like he would do for a normal human being. I think the thing was that he could not be killed any other way also. That was also, which was the boon which he had.
Oh, but it's interesting, for whatever reason, Bhagwan, as you said, summarizes this entire thing in just one paragraph, because even the story that is there in the Ramakatha Rasavahini just states that he had been cursed by Kubera and he was released by Rama. Reading the Ramakatha Rasavahini, I was absolutely unaware of what is there in the Valmiki Ramayana till you narrated it now. But reading the Ramakatha Rasavahini, I just felt, was this person, this Virada, now you have revealed that his name was Tumburu, was Tumburu cursed actually, or was he blessed? Because when the Lord comes actually, when the Lord is by your side, when it pertains to God, I don't think there's anything called a curse. Reading his story, you feel that Virada was so blessed. In fact, you see, even Dasharatha did not have the blessing of having his funeral rites performed by Rama, the Lord of the universe, though Rama was his own son. But that blessing, this Virada, Tumburu, this person gets it. It's so amazing, it makes you wonder whether what Kubera's cursed was actually a curse. Now, we can't ascertain what were Kubera's intentions. Was he wanting to bless him and he put a curse on him, which was a blessing in disguise? We can leave all that out. But one thing that becomes very evident from reading the Ramakatha Rasavahini, this story, is whether it's a blessing or a curse, it's always a blessing if it pertains to the Lord. Once you're with the Lord, once you're with Swami, once you have Swami by your side, once you live in Swami's name, once you enshrine Him in your heart, once you enthrone Him in your life, then there's nothing like a curse in your life. Whatever difficulty may come, whatever hardship may come, whatever may be what you think is cursed, you will have the serenity, peace, calm, and the conviction to know that it is just a blessing, possibly in disguise. That's all. So that becomes very evident when we read this episode.
And the other thing is, one statement which Swami has made many times before is, he would say that the avatars came with different weapons. Rama came with a bow and arrow, and Krishna came with the chakra. Swami would say, I've come with only one weapon, and that's the weapon of love. And if you just put that in this particular template which we have formed, where curses are coming, cursed beings are coming and getting liberated by Lord Rama. Many a times, honestly, when we look at Swami, we always have this doubt of why this person is getting so much of attention. Because in our worldly reasoning, we feel that person does not deserve it. he seems to be a person who's
bad,
you know, who's apparently bad or negative or, you know, doesn't deserve that kind of a grace. But we always see that that person gets so much of attention from Swami, so much of love from Swami. If you look at it that way, you know, maybe you never know what's the past of the person who's getting that attention. And in the, Treta Yuga or the Dwapara Yuga, Swami used the weapon which he had in his hand. And here, Swami said, my weapon is love. So maybe the process of liberating that person from that negative, you know, persona which he was adorning that time, maybe was through this special attention which Swami had to give. So I think it's very important for us to not be judgmental. I think we have told it so many times, more to ourselves than
exactly.
to our listeners
exactly.
when more we narrate it. But I think it's becoming more and more common because, you know, when we talk of Gandharvas, it is an elevated state of being. You know, when you talk of human being, that is a certain blessing which takes for you to be a human being. When you're a person who lives in a higher plane of existence, like in that of the heavenly abode or in the, you know, in the Puranas you say the Shivaloka, the Vishnuloka, the Brahmaloka, you know, these are all certain higher levels of existence. If a person who has been living in that existence, you know, has been living in the kingdom of Kubera, could come down to the level of a man-eating ogre, you know, that's the amount of difference we go by so much of what we see. If you see a person who is, let's say you see a cannibal now, you know, our approach to that person is so different. We see him as downright evil, but you never know what is the past which has led to that, and because that's when our human reasoning actually breaks down completely.
Exactly. While Rama blesses Virata in this manner, you know, when Swami says that his love is for all, God's love is for everyone, that's what becomes evident here. Because Virata gets the same blessing as the next soul. Now, as the next soul that we are going to see gets, while Virata is condemned as a demon and ogre and somebody who is fit to be just killed, the next being is someone worthy of all our adoration and worthy of emulation. And that is sage Sarabhanga. It is said that Sarabhanga has done penance and tapas for several decades, and there is a glow about him. He is a very, very spiritually elevated being. And as we read the Ramkatha Rasavahini, we realize that he has kept his body alive only for the sake of seeing Lord Sri Rama. In fact, when Lord Rama comes, this is the famous story where he prepares a funeral pyre actually. And he prays to Lord Rama saying, Lord Rama, you are the fructification, the fulfillment of my entire life. All the tapofala that I have, you know, all the fruits of penance that I have, I offer to you. Because all that was done just to get you, and once I have got you, I have no use for those fruits of my penance. So that is how he offers all his penance at the feet of Rama. Again, you know, there are so many levels of meaning here. So he offers that to Rama, and then he says, Rama, now that I have seen you, there is nothing else left in the universe for me to see, hear or do, nothing. That's done. And that is why, you know, he builds a yogic pyre, with his own capacity. And in that fire, he immolates himself. You know, on the face of it, this might appear like a suicide. And if someone says that, how is it that the Lord encourages suicide? There are a lot of difference. You know, when you see a suicide victim, when you see somebody immolating himself or herself somewhere, you see the kind of struggle they go through, the amount of pain that they go through, okay, which shows that they identify themselves completely with the body. They are not yet liberated because they know that they are the body and they feel that they are experiencing pain. But see the case of sage Sarabhanga. Even as his skin is scalding, as his eyeballs melt out of the sockets and his whole body is burning, he is having a blissful smile. He is feeling no pain at all. So once one is liberated, yes, the body is given for a purpose, and that purpose is to liberate the being within. And once that liberation is achieved, there is no further use for the body. And so therefore, on the face of it, this appears to be like a suicide. It is definitely not the case. It is a case of fulfillment and fructification. And therefore, as Sage Sarabhanga sits in that yogic pyre that he has created, his entire being is filled with joy, and without the slightest murmur of pain or slightest hint of suffering, he just lets go of the physical frame and becomes complete ashes. In fact, Swami writes that the other residents of the ashram, his disciples, they are first grief-stricken because their master is now gone. Because it has not yet sunk in them about the magnitude of blessing that he has achieved. And once that starts sinking, they go ahead, take the ash that is remaining from his pyre and apply it across their forehead as vibhuti.
Now again, this particular episode is very interestingly different in the Valmiki Ramayana. Because if you look at one of the main difference, as we started off, we said this, you know, between Swami's account of the Ramayana and Valmiki's, you know, where Valmiki Ramayana is that of a human being looking at a fellow human being with certain enhanced qualities at best. But Swami was always talking of it at the level of he is the incarnation of the ultimate Parabrahman. So you would always find that, you know, the tone of Swami being that, yes, he is the ultimate, he is the ultimate. But in the Valmiki Ramayana, there are very, very few instances where Valmiki reveals that Rama himself says that I am the ultimate. Because, you know, that is the boon which Ravana has at the end of the day, that he can be killed only by a human being. So the drama is played out in such a way that Rama never reveals. In fact, there are dialogues where, you know, some of the sages come and tell him that you're the ultimate. So then Rama says, no, I'm not the, you know, the greatest, or I'm just the prince of Ayodhya, the son of Dashrata. You would have that dialogue repeating in many places in the Ramayana. But this particular episode, where he comes to Sarabhanga, you know, the way it is described, as Rama and Lakshmana approach this sage's ashram, they actually see a heavenly palanquin or a chariot waiting to take Sarabhanga. They see a divine being in that chariot, and they see the sight, and Rama tells Lakshmana, hey, look at that, I think it is Lord Indra who has come. So he says, come, let us go and meet him. The moment they start approaching towards the ashram, Indra tells Sarabhanga that, you know, see, Rama is coming, this is not the opportune moment for me to have his darshan, so let me leave before he comes here. So he goes, and then they reach Sarabhanga, and then they ask him, who is that, you know, divine heavenly being who is here? Then Sarabhanga says that it was Lord Indra who has come to take me to the heaven. And then Sarabhanga says, tells Lord Rama that I've refused that offer because I knew that you were coming and I've been waiting for that. So he says, I've turned down an offer to go to heaven so that I can be a host to you. And at this point, Rama says that, you know, I'm so pleased with you, O sage. Tell me which world you want. I will bring it down here for you. You know, for that one moment, he reveals that, you know, everything, be it heaven or any other world, it is under my control. Tell me which one you want. I'll bring it down here for you. And that is when, you know, Sarabhanga says that I don't want anything, but just give me this boon, that let me see you as I die. So he is, I think, one of those rare characters who has this opportunity, which even Dasharatha did not have. Now later we will speak of Jatayu, who had the opportunity to die at, you know, Rama's lap. And this is the story of Sarabhanga as told in the Valmiki Ramayana, actually.
That is, again, very beautiful. Dear listeners, the time in our studio is 1:58, and it is time for us to conclude our satsang. We know that we began a little late today, but, well, as they say, in order to enjoy the taste of the sugar syrup, you don't need to drink the whole bottle. A sip is enough, two sips are enough, three sips are enough. In the same way, though the quantity of time we might have spent may be less, the quality is always sweet because it is about our Lord. We will leave you with this song in Bhagwan's own voice, where, you know, it's actually a bhajan which Swami sings, in which he summarizes many parts of the Ramayana. There is the third stanza here where he sings actually about this sage, this Muni Sarabhanga. So we thought it would be best to conclude with Bhagwan's own voice singing this bhajan, Rama 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 Sita. On the other side of the song, there will be Brother Chandu's segment, Love to Love. And with this, we conclude this fortnight of Ramakatha Rasa Vahini. The next fortnight will be on other topics, after which the coming fortnight after that, once again, we will take up the Ramakatha Rasa Vahini. We hope you're enjoying the sweet story of Rama, just as we are enjoying it. Do write to us at listener@radiosai.org with your feedback, comments, and thoughts. They are most welcome. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
ರಾಮ 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 ಸೀತಾರಾಮ ರಾಮ 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 ಸೀತಾರಾಮ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ
ಸೀತಾರಾಮ
ರಾಮ 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 ಸೀತಾರಾಮ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ
ಸೀತಾರಾಮ
ಶ್ರೀಮತ್ಯ ವಿಪುಲ ಮಂಗುಜನಿಂಚಿ ಸೀತಾದೇವಿನಿ ಪ್ರೀತಿ ವರಿಂಚಿ ಪ್ರೇಮನ ಹರ್ಯಾಶಾಪ ಮುದಿಯುಚ್ಚಿ ಪ್ರಿಯ ಭಕ್ತುಲ ರಕ್ಷಿಂಚಿನ ಶ್ರೀರಘು ರಾಮ 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 ಮುಂದುಗ ಹನುಮಂತುನಿ ದೀವಿಂಚಿ ಮುದಮಲರಗರವಿಸುತು ಪಾಲಿಂಚಿ ಚೆಂಡಿನ ಕಿನುಕತ ವಾಲಿನಿ ದುಂಚಿ ಚೇರಿನ ವಾನರ ಪೀರುಲ ಬ್ರೋಚಿನ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ ಕರದೂಷಣ ಮುಖ ಧನುಜುಲ ದೃಂಚಿ ಕರುಣ ಜಟಾಯು ಗತಿ ಸವರಿಂಚಿ ಶರಭಂಗಾತಿ ಮುನೀಂದ್ರುಲ ಬೋಚಿ ಶಬರಿ ಫಲಮುಲು ಪ್ರೇಮ ಭುಜಿಂಚಿನ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ ರಾವಣಾದಿ ಸುರ ವೈರುಲ ದೃಂಚಿ ರಮಣಿ ತೋಡ ಸಾಧುಲ ಪಾಲಿಂಚಿ ಆವನ ರಾಶಿನಿ ನೀಟು ಬಂದಿಂಚಿ ಆಧರ ಮುಗ ವಿಭೀಷಣ ಬ್ರೋಚಿನ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ ನಿಜ ಸಹೋದರು ನೀನು ಸೇವಿಂಚಗ
ಸೇವಿಂಚಿ
ಇನ್ನು ಗೊಲ್ಕಿ ಪ್ರಜಲಲ್ಲ ಸುಖಿಂಪಗ ಅಜಕರಾದು ಸುರುಲೆಲ್ಲರು ತಿಂಪಗ ಆನಂದಮುತೋ ಅಯೋಜ್ಯನೇಯಿನ ರಾಮ 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 ಸೀತಾ
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 ರಾಮ ರಾಮ ರಾಮ